Thanks for joining us. I'm Tamara Keith of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's having a voice treatment. Today, music is an integral part of presidential campaigns, getting supporters pumped up on the trail, bringing a candidate onto or off of stage with a theme song that speaks to their platform or personality. In the 1992 election, Bill Clinton used Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop as a campaign song, a choice some say helped solidify his victory. In that same year, Ross Perot used Patsy Cline's Crazy, which may have helped cement a different sort of image for the candidate.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Oh, I love that one. But the use of music on the campaign trail actually goes all the way back to our country's beginnings. Here in studio with me to talk about the history and current role of music in presidential campaigns is entertainment and intellectual property lawyer Sarah Schachter. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco is composer, pianist, and music historian Robert Greenberg.
Great to be here.
And by phone from Rice Lake, Wisconsin, is political scientist Eric Casper, who has written a book all about campaign music. I'm glad that you are all here joining us for this. And for this program, it is ever so important to get our listeners to call in with their ideas, their favorite campaign songs, or their favorite mismatched campaign songs. The number to call is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org or on Twitter at drshow. Eric Casper, let's start with you. When did presidents or presidential candidates start using music as part of their campaigns?
First, thank you for having me on this morning. The use of campaign music does, as you mentioned earlier, go all the way back to the country's founding, although initially, it was after the first election of President Washington, it was kind of used as music to celebrate his inauguration, and that became the de facto music that was then used when he ran for re-election the next time. You see music being used as part of the campaigns, but not as an integral part during the first several presidential elections. And the watershed moment really is in 1840, where of course, still well-known song today of Tippecanoe and Tyler II really came to the fore and was an important part of that campaign.
Well, I think we should hear a little bit of Tippecanoe and Tyler II. We have that music queued up, and let's hear it.
Has heard the great commotion, motion, motion all the country through. It is the ball a-rolling on for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with them will be little Van, Van, Van is a used up man, and with them will be little Van.
Sarah Schachter, that is the first attack ad song?
I think that's possible. I mean, going back to a little further back, there were tunes written to lampoon Thomas Jefferson involving, you know, references to Sally Hemings. So it goes back a little bit further, nastiness in politics. But that's a great example of a sort of an attack song, a historic attack song. So,
Robert, some of the early campaign songs were called Contra Facta? What does that mean?
A contra facta is a pre-existing tune, presumably a well-known pre-existing tune, that's been fitted out with new words. You know, in a pre-media age and pre-20th century, we're talking about pre-electronic media, a campaign song was a great way to sell a message, especially if you fitted new words to a tune everyone knew, like Yankee Doodle, or a tune called Anacreon in Heaven, which was used by the John Adams campaign, later became known as the Star-Spangled Banner, an old English drinking song. If you have a tune that everyone already knows, it's easy to memorize the words. And, of course, unlike pamphlets in the early days of campaigns, folks were fairly illiterate then, or less literate than we are now, at least. And a song was a great way to memorize a message and to repeat that message over and over again. You know, candidates can speak for themselves today. But again, pre-media, candidates didn't have that opportunity to speak for themselves unless they were actually present. But the song could travel anywhere at any time. So contra facta, frankly, were the most common sort of campaign tunes, all the way up through at least Lyndon Johnson's campaign. He used a tune called Hello, Lyndon, which was a takeoff on Hello, Dolly. And Carol Channing actually sang Hello, Lyndon, and Jerry Herman, who wrote the original Hello, Dolly, wrote the words for Hello, Lyndon. And again, everyone would have recognized that song right away, and it would be easy to memorize.
Eric, I want to go back just a little bit, back to the 1840s. You say a couple of things changed then, and I think that Robert sort of alluded to them. What changed in the 1840s to make campaign music so much more important?
Well, what you see happening, especially in the 1830s, leading up to that 1840 election, is the expansion of the right to vote and property qualifications being removed across the country during that time. So
people wouldn't have to be property owners to vote.
Right. And so, you know, what that did is it not only expanded the right to vote by about 60% in that decade leading up to 1840, but what that also did is it changed the demographics of the voters. So you had a larger percentage of the voting population now that was illiterate or it was less educated. And so, you know, printing up campaign literature and distributing that would not have been an effective means of getting your message out, but playing music would have been.
I want to play another little bit of music. This was an old Irish drinking song, but then it became a campaign song.
Hurrah for the choice of our nation, our heroes so brave and so true. Go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the boy from Kentucky.
So, Robert, why don't we have songs like that anymore on the campaign trail?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of reasons, and one of them might be the fact that the basic demographic that's voting now, or at least the largest demographic that's voting now, or should be voting, are people that grew up listening to rock and roll. And rock and roll is a dance music. It's a very rhythmic music. And it's music in which the words, let's say, might play a lesser importance. And certain substantial musical elements like harmony and melody are perhaps less important than simple beat and rhythm. A rock and roll song is not so easily memorized. The words might not be interesting. And frankly, so much rock and roll is it's a function of the people who created it. My favorite example is trying to imagine someone else reinterpreting the Stones' Satisfaction. I Ain't Got No Satisfaction. Or trying to use something like that in a campaign song. Really, what makes that song memorable is its original performance style, not so much the substance of the music itself. So it's hard to take rock and roll and to plug new words into it. Besides for which, the media, given what it is now, it's easier to try to associate oneself with a performer. Everyone, for example, wants to be associated with someone like Bruce Springsteen, right? I mean, here you have a basic working man guy, a real blue-collar musician who talks about the American worker and the basic values of the culture. So I think a lot of it is how we associate with certain figures today, how the media works, and also the nature of the music that we would be substituting words into. Old march songs, drinking songs, yes, these were songs. These were pieces in which melody, harmony, and a lyric of some interest were of tantamount importance. That's hard to do in rock and roll.
Eric Casper, at what point did we see this shift where popular music became campaign music? Well, I mean, well, rock and roll-ish popular music.
Well, as we've already heard, I mean, there's kind of several factors that play into this. But as you progress through the middle and toward the end of the 20th century, as you have social movements that are using folk music and that are using more popular types of music, you also see campaigns start to use that as well. At the same time, you're seeing advertisers switch to using pop music in their commercials, and so this kind of becomes the new way to get the message out. And so by the time you get to 1984, you have the Reagan campaign using God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood. By 1992, you have the Clinton campaign, as you played earlier, using Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop. You know, by then, it's pretty much cemented because of these changes that are out there in terms of what social movements have done. What lowering the voting age, that certainly helped as well to use this pop music to appeal to younger voters, and the technological changes as well, which led to it being easier to just simply play pre-recorded music on the campaign trail.
Coming up, more of our conversation about campaign music, and we'll get to the part about candidates using songs that the musicians didn't really want them to use. And we also want to hear from you. Take your calls and your emails and your tweets at DR Show.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Tamara Keith, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And that, of course, is Bruce Springsteen singing Born in the USA. This show is all about campaign music. And we have an email here from Frank. He says, please discuss the details of Ronald Reagan using the Bruce Springsteen song Born in the USA and not being aware of the criticism of America in it. Let's go first to Robert Greenberg in San Francisco, composer, pianist, music historian. Tell us the story of that.
I wish I knew it. We're going to have to turn to Eric Casper someone who knows more about these things.
Eric Casper, all you.
Sure. It was what it originated from was a campaign stop in New Jersey by the Reagan campaign in 1984. He talked about Bruce Springsteen. He talked about America's future resting in, as he put it, 1,000 dreams inside our hearts. It rests in the message of hope in the songs of the man so many young Americans admire, New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen, and helping you make those dreams come true is what the job of mine is all about. And so he was, of course, referring to Born in the USA. Of course, if you're familiar with the song and if you listen closely to the lyrics, you know that it's not exactly a song celebrating what was going on at the time when he wrote the song. It was talking about things that were bad that had happened in his hometown, and you know things that were, you know, his friend when he was in Vietnam, at least speaking as the person in the song, who was killed and he came back home, and you know there was job loss and so forth. So there was a bit of a disconnect there between what the kind of the title and the hook of the song is, which sounds very patriotic compared to the rest of the lyrics, where it's not exactly that same hopeful message, although one could make the same argument with something like Bill Clinton's use of Don't Stop by Fleetwood Mac, which was originally written as a song about a breakup between two of the band members. So, you know, these songs get repurposed by these campaigns all
Sarah Schachter, you are an intellectual property lawyer at Loeb & Loeb.
I am.
What happens when a musician doesn't like what the campaign did? In this case, Bruce Springsteen was not happy. Generally speaking, Bruce Springsteen has objected frequently to his songs being used.
Well, usually what happens is you get a complaint, either in the form of a public statement or a cease and desist letter from an attorney from the artist who doesn't want their music being used in a way that's sort of contrary to their political beliefs or their message. Sometimes that works, and I think there's been a bit of a shift lately, and campaigns are becoming a little bit more sensitive to this issue than they used to be, and really just more pragmatically wanting to avoid, you know, getting into some sort of argument with an artist who doesn't really want to be a part of your candidate's message. Like, why would you want to force that artist on your, you know, on your message and create an issue that is sort of almost embarrassing a little bit to the candidate sometimes? So, you know, from there could be litigation. There's not always litigation. There are sort of two big examples of cases that were sort of litigated in a real way, but it's not often that it goes that far. A lot of times these things, you know, either the politician agrees to sort of step back and not use the song, or the case settles in some other way. So,
and sometimes the candidate is actually on board. Thinking of High Hopes.
Right. I mean, I think that's a really interesting example of a situation where the candidate was, you know, reached out to the artist and really made the artist a part of the message and a willing participant in the message. And I think that has a couple of advantages, not only in the sense that there's legal advantages and that you don't incur the wrath of the artist or sort of any sort of legal issue, but also it seems like those are the examples where maybe the best uses of music in a lot of ways. As you mentioned, High Hopes was a song that was used by JFK's campaign. It was Frank Sinatra sang the song, and it was rewritten with lyrics that referenced Jack and JFK, and Frank Sinatra sang that song. And I think that was sort of a big advantage to have him on board, and certainly who wouldn't want to be associated with Frank Sinatra?
Let's hear a little bit of that.
Is voting for Jack, 'cause he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track, 'cause he's got...
Robert, does this kind of thing do anything to dilute the brand of the musician?
Well, as you say, if the musician's interested in it, if the musician is part of it, I don't think so at all. Frankly, if someone wanted to use something I wrote in a campaign, oh my goodness, I might turn a blind eye to the politics and simply be thrilled that so many people were hearing something that I did. Speaking for myself, I don't think so. But certainly, you know, if there are political extremes involved, yes. What I observe and what I see and what kind of tickles my fancy is that so many of the musicians are more to the left, and so when a candidate to the right wants to use his or her music, there are problems. But we haven't seen the opposite. And I would like to see Bernie Sanders use some Ted Nugent. I think that would... That would be fun. I'd like to see how the other side reacts.
That would be an interesting development. And actually,
yes, indeed.
We have a call here from Tim in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Tim, you want to talk about Bernie Sanders, is that right?
Yes, and actually, comment on a couple of points you've already made, which is ironic, on Trump's Escalator song with Neil Young using about rocking America.
Yeah, keep on rocking in the free world from Neil Young.
Yeah, and in fact, the lyrics on that, you know, get into the song, you know, it's talking about, you know, drug use and leaving, you know, baby beside a dumpster and things of that nature. And then, of course, the next day, Neil Young, which is a longtime Bernie Sanders supporter, had objected in using the song. So, if Mr. Young or Mr. Sanders is listening, hopefully, it'd be nice if he would actually write him a song for a campaign. And or there's a song for Bernie Sanders that I think would be appropriate. It was back in the 90s sometime, I believe, by Van Halen. called Right Now, and it's talking about needing to make a change right now. Matter of fact, it's got a video that's very appropriate for it as well, about the things that are wrong in the world today. And I think we need to make a change, especially along those lines.
Well, Tim, thank you for your call. And I want to hear a little bit of Rockin' in the Free World, and then let's talk to our guests about what happened when Donald Trump rode down his golden escalator to the tune of Rockin' in the Free World. Eric Casper, what ultimately happened with this?
Well, as the caller alluded to, Neil Young was not impressed by this, and he released a statement shortly thereafter saying that Donald Trump was not authorized to use it, and that he supports Bernie Sanders instead. And the Trump campaign claimed that they cleared it with the copyright holder, but Neil Young was kind of going a step beyond that, saying that that Trump was trying to give an implied endorsement, basically trying to project to voters that he had the support of Neil Young. And that's another common issue we see in more recent years, not only issues where the campaign uses a song without the copyright permission, which may be held by someone other than the artist, but even if they do have copyright permission to use the song, sometimes the artist will still publicly object, and then that again kind of defeats the purpose of using the song, because you get this negative publicity associated with it.
And this story has something of a happy ending, because Bernie Sanders is now using Rockin' in the Free World for his events, and Donald Trump has a new song. He's using We're Not Gonna Take It by Twisted Sister. And Sarah Schachter, you're in the studio here. You're nodding your head about the copyright issues here.
We focus on copyright, and copyright's really important, but important to keep in mind that there are other sort of claims that artists can bring, even if they don't have the, even if they're not holders of the copyrights and can't make a claim based on that. And so it's always, best to, as we mentioned earlier, work with the artist and not fight the artist, because there are claims based on, association. So there's a claim under the Federal Lanham Act, which is a trademark act, but has a section that involves false association or false endorsement. And sometimes artists will bring a claim under that act, even if, they're, or in addition to their copyright claim, or if they don't have a copyright claim, and say, you're falsely implying that I'm endorsing your message. And that's against the statute. So, and there's another type of claim called a right of publicity claim, which is another claim that artists can bring that's a state law claim and varies from state to state. And basically that claim would be an unauthorized commercial use, typically, of and usually a celebrity's public image to sell something, to sell a product. And so some artists have claimed that this is also, this kind of situation would violate the right of publicity, the right that they, the property right, essentially, that they have in their persona.
You said earlier that there have been at least a couple cases where it has actually made it all the way to court, where there's been actual legal action. Can you tell us about those, or your favorite
Sure.
one at least?
Well, there's two big ones. I think in some ways they're both interesting, and they both go to this question of whether an artist can say, or a candidate can say, I changed this song in some way, and so it's not copyright infringement. And what that goes to is a defense to copyright infringement called fair use, which is essentially a First Amendment-based defense that defendants often raise to a claim of copyright infringement. And the question, it often boils down to whether the use is what's called transformative, which means did the user, so in this case, did the candidate take the song and do something to change the message behind it and really give it a new meaning? In which case, it might not be copyright infringement, even if, it wasn't a licensed use, or if they didn't have a permission. This is usually not a great argument, it turns out, in a political campaign context. And I would say that artists should not, or candidates should not, rely on being able to raise that kind of defense of transformativeness or a parody defense.
I'm Tamara Keith of NPR. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to call us, please do. It's 1-800-433-8850. You can send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. We have a few notes that have come in over the web, and I want to read a few of them to you. One listener writes, I don't know if this was their favorite or their least favorite campaign song, but it's Arnold Schwarzenegger used the same song that Donald Trump is now using, which is "We're not going to take it." The listener says, quote, "I hated that campaign. Do I need to explain why? When Dee Snider performed it live at a rally, the song was ruined for me forever." Let's hear a little bit of it just for kicks. That was a little bit of Twisted Sister and a song that's been used on a couple of campaigns, both Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign and now Donald Trump's campaign. And I want to go to the phones and Dave in Sarasota, Florida. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an old 45 record I came across, and it's from a Richard Nixon campaign song for president, and it goes to Merrily We Roll Along, and I think there's another song they fused in there also. And I was always curious, first of all, what campaign that may have come from, and secondly, if presidential candidates often combine two or three songs in one campaign song.
Eric Casper or Robert Greenberg, do either of you have any knowledge of this particular song?
Not this one. The one that I know from Nixon is Buckle Down with Nixon, based on the music of Buckle Down Winsaki. So this might have been, it could have been a presidential campaign song, but it could very well have been one of his congressional songs as well.
Eric Casper, are you going to bow out on that one?
I'm not sure about, because I'm not familiar with the music, but I know, you know, Nixon used a few songs in his presidential campaigns, including Nixon's The One and Nixon Now. And it was still during that era when you had a lot of these songs being written for the campaigns yet.
Was we now have these copyright issues or these issues where candidates try something and then musicians get grumpy. What point did that start happening, that we now have these regular clashes? It's sort of like a great tradition of every presidential campaign that you're going to get a bunch of complaints. Eric, when did that happen?
Well, it really starts to take off only in about the last 20 years. There are some isolated incidents of that. As we talked about earlier, the Johnson campaign had made use of a modified version of Hello Dolly with Hello Lyndon. The Goldwater campaign in 1964 also tried to do the same thing, but David Merrick wouldn't allow that and publicly objected. You had the use of Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin in 1988 for a time by the then Vice President George H.W. Bush running for president, and McFerrin objected to the use of that. But it really doesn't take off until you get into really about the year 2000, it's also the era when we start seeing these campaigns using more and more songs, and basically trying to have different songs through time during the campaign and different songs that they play as they're campaigning in different geographical locations throughout the country. And so as they start using more and more songs, they start running into just more artists then who are objecting since really the year 2000.
I was on the campaign with Mitt Romney following along, and we get to Ohio and they start playing Hang On Sloopy, which is the Ohio State fight song. So the campaigns definitely try to be appropriate to their location. Mm-hmm. Coming up, we're going to take your calls and your questions for our panel. We're going to play some more music and talk some more about campaign songs. Thanks for listening. Welcome back. I'm Tamara Keith of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And today we are talking about campaign music, campaign theme songs, and how they've changed over time. And Robert Greenberg, you're a composer and a pianist and a music historian. And I just wonder, what do you think makes a great campaign song?
Well, if we're going to talk about the pre-last 20 years, which is what I would do. Listen, the whole point of the whole point of all of this campaign music, this is advertising music. These are jingles. These are opportunities to use words and music to intensify the meaning of a campaign. That's always the beauty of music, by the way. You know, words by themselves are not capable of as much as they are expressing when music is attached to them. And this is something we've known culturally going back to the very beginning. Ancient Greeks used music in religion and theater, and we've been using it in religion and theater since then, too, to deepen meaning, always. Music deepens the meaning of words. So what makes a great campaign song, what makes a great song of any kind, because a song, by definition, is a simply accompanied piece of poetry in which music intensifies the meaning of the poetry. What would make a great campaign song is something that has a message, delivers the message, deepens the message through memorable music. It makes people want to sing it. It makes people want to listen to it. And in listening to it, they get the message over and over again. And this is why I'm intrigued by these contra facta, these old pre-existing melodies that everyone knew fitted out with new words, because those words become instantly deepened and made more substantial by music people knew. So I think what makes a great campaign song is the same thing that makes a great song, a great jingle, a great piece of musical theater. And that is a message that is deepened and made transcendent through the addition of music, something that people can remember, and something that somehow can sway their feelings in a way that the words by themselves cannot.
I want to play a little clip. You talk about jingles. This one sounds just like something straight out of Mad Men. It's called I Like Ike.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John
or Dean
or Harry.
Let's do that big job right. Let's get in step with the guy that's left. Get in step with Ike. You like Ike.
Robert, does that one count for you as giving new meaning, or at least it's an earworm?
You know, it's ear candy. It's a great jingle, and that's an advertising jingle, and that was no doubt written by someone who had to sell his or her message in a 10 or 15 second period of time.
Eric Casper, you've played this one for your students, right? Your modern day political science students?
Yes, I mean I think it's a wonderful song personally. I like Ike, but when I play it for my students at UW-Eau Claire, you know, they're kind of like, what is this? You know, this is not something that they're used to, and it's not something that's going to appeal to them. And it's, you know, that's why modern campaigns have largely moved away from it. And what you're seeing today instead is picking a song that's already popular, as that hook of the song, you know, that key line that reinforces whatever your message is, whether it's we're not going to take it, or it's Born Free, or We Take Care of Our Own, or some of these other songs that have been used recently. And also, if you do have the artist who sings the song behind your campaign, then, you know, you invite them out to the rallies, you announce that major celebrity artist is going to be there, it attracts people to the rallies who otherwise might not go, and then once they're there, it's more likely that you can get them involved in terms of volunteering with the campaign. So, I mean, there are some big benefits to picking that song where you have the celebrity power of that artist, and if you can get that artist to come along with you, someone like Bruce Springsteen, who we talked about earlier.
I have an email here from Matt in Cincinnati. He writes, are there any recent examples of candidates having original music written for their campaigns? And I see a hand up, Sarah Schachter here, the entertainment lawyer.
I learned recently that I believe Rick Santorum had a song written for him. It's called Take Back America, and he's got it for sale on his campaign website. So both you know, avoiding any potential legal issues or potential artists complaining, and also using it then to, you know, raise money, which is another advantage to that.
Robert, you also noted this song.
Well, I just would love to see Don Trump hire someone to write something for his campaign, because there are just very few words that rhyme with Trump, and the ones that come to mind are bump and dump and lump and rump, and I'd like to see how someone would get around that.
That might be why he's sticking with Twisted Sister.
I happen to agree with you, yes.
Let's go to Simeon in Rochester, New York. Simeon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. So I wanted to remind people that in 1968, Bobby Kennedy, when he was running for president, chose as his campaign theme song, "This Land Is Your Land." And the premise behind that choice, I think, is that he wanted his song to reflect what his campaign was all about, which was to try to unify people and bring people together around a global, broad, inclusive vision of America. And it's no coincidence that he was the last major presidential candidate to attract white ethnics as well as African Americans to support him. Wouldn't it be great if a candidate today would choose that or a similar song that had as its goal unifying people and bringing people together to say, this land is your land. America belongs to all of us. Instead of a song that it creates wedge issues.
Eric Casper?
Yeah, I think that's an example of a song where, you know, the title and the hook and, you know, all the lyrics together kind of reinforce the same message, and the way that it was being used by Robert Kennedy in 1968 fits that message. We you know, heard the example earlier of Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, which, you know, Reagan had used that year, or he at least referred to it that year, which didn't quite fit as well. Although Reagan did in 1984 also use God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood, which, again, kind of fits the types of values that the Reagan campaign was espousing. So it's not like these campaigns are always, you know, picking music and there's some sort of problem. Sometimes it does fit together quite well.
I have a listener email here, and apparently this listener is not the only person suggesting this. I'm going to read it for you. "Since Bernie Sanders has been running for president, I've told friends that I think he needs to get the rights to the Blue Oyster Cult song, Burning for You." And then it would go, and now I'm going to do something I'm going to regret. "I'm Bernie, I'm Bernie, I'm Bernie for you." Something to that effect. Robert, as a musician, do you think that works?
You know, you've left me speechless, which happens very rarely. As a musician, I'm constantly stunned by what works out there. I'm always amazed by what folks are willing to hear. If they liked Ike, someone would probably like "I'm Bernie for You" as well. Who knows? You know, we're not talking about musical quality or integrity here. We're talking about memorability, sellability, and does something resonate with some aspect of the spirit of the campaign? So if Bernie Sanders was willing to get up there and sing it for everybody and lead them in the song, that would be just great, because he would become a man of the people, he would become a man of music, he would become a man who's willing to make himself look a little foolish in order to make his point. So it all depends on the context. I don't think we're talking about high art here. We're talking about selling.
Yes. I mean, this is, at its core, advertising or something. Sarah Schachter, there is at times a conflict between the artist who wrote the song and had a certain meaning for that song and the politician who, in some cases, that they don't agree with. Whose First Amendment rights take precedent here?
Right. I mean, I think that's kind of the key question, and a really interesting question. And, you know, on the one hand, you have a candidate who is engaging in what we would think of as being core political speech. So some, you know, in a lot of ways, the most important kind of speech, because it's the speech that educates the electorate and allows the electorate to then make an informed decision about who they want to be their president. And so that's obviously very important. On the other hand, you have an artist who doesn't want to be sort of a forced participant in that speech. And that to me also represents a First Amendment interest. I don't know if it's not necessarily a legal claim in the sense of being a First Amendment claim, but it's important too, because it's in a way a compelled speech or a compelled association. And so it creates this interesting clash of sort of First Amendment interests, both on the part of the artist and the candidate. And it's I think a hard thing to navigate in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, political speech is so important, and we want candidates to be able to use music to express themselves and really kind of introduce themselves to the electorate. But on the other hand, we don't really like misleading speech. So a speech that tends to imply that an artist is associated or endorses a campaign is not really speech that's helpful, I think.
I want to go to email here. Catherine in Michigan writes, "I'll never, all caps, forget Bill Clinton's entrance at a stop in East Lansing, Michigan during his 1996 campaign. It was dark at night, and there were thousands of students there from Michigan State University. Clinton stepped off the train to the bright lights and throbbing beat of 'Are you ready for this?' And the crowd went wild." Eric Casper, how much of campaign music is about getting those people in the crowd excited?
Well, music has a certain emotional power over us, and so this is a way to kind of get people ramped up, either, you know, as the candidate's coming in or right at the end of the speech. And, you know, either way, you know, that helps with the image that's being projected on camera when you have the media there covering this, and, you know, they see the big roaring crowd. And, you know, music certainly helps with that. I would kind of analogize campaigns to two other campaign strategies. One is, in some ways, it's kind of similar to what you have on late-night talk shows when candidates appear on there. It's kind of a different way to get the message out, to reinforce the campaign's message, and perhaps to get it out to people who otherwise wouldn't hear that message. At the same time, though, when I think about, well, how many people are actually swayed to vote for a candidate because of their song, and I think that that's a pretty small percentage of the electorate. In some ways, I analogize campaign music to campaign yard signs. You know, next summer and next fall, you know, yards across the country will be littered with these campaign yard signs. And I don't think that there are a whole lot of people who are swayed to vote one way or the other based on yard signs, but campaigns still do it, and they still spend money and time putting those yard signs together and getting them out there because the other side is doing it as well, and they don't want to fall behind. And I think music in some ways is similar to that. You know the other side's going to use music, so you'd better do it too, because you don't want to lose that edge, especially in a close election.
I'm Tamara Keith, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Eric, the candidates have started putting together playlists. Hillary Clinton has a playlist that she's put up on Spotify that includes things like Shake It Off from Taylor Swift. What do you make of the candidate playlist? She's definitely not the first one to do it.
No, and we saw that in 2012, the President Obama's campaign and Mitt Romney's campaign, they each did one of these as well. It's another example of, changes in technology and changes in the law, quite frankly, or at least recognizing the law, changing how these campaigns conduct themselves with respect to music. Obviously, Spotify lists are not something that you could have done in 1992 or 1964 or in the past, because Spotify wasn't around.
Yeah.
It's there now, and so they're making use of it, and it's a way for them to get this message out that the song projects, but not running into those same copyright issues, because they're not playing the song. They're just listing off, here are the songs that represent my campaign. And so it's a way of kind of avoiding some of the potential problems that come up if they play the music without permission. But it's also getting that same message out there in a new way, because it becomes a news story and people pay attention to it.
We have an email from Brian. He says, "I'm a union musician in the greater Detroit area and make my living playing jazz. I've been asked to and have participated in events like the Democratic State Caucus in Detroit in the past." He says, "I know from experience that even on a grassroots level, music creates a visceral reaction that can give a candidate a definite edge over the competition." Robert Greenberg, music as an edge?
No doubt. I would have to agree with that. especially today, you know, we're so surrounded by sensory experience all the time. That's one of the beauties and banes of our media world as it exists now. We're never more than a finger click away from, or a finger flick away from anything. And, you know, the Spotify list, for example, it's a perfect example. We lived for so long without Spotify lists, and now that we have them, we can't live without them. We need an advantage. We're always looking, no matter what we do, for a competitive edge. And music has become part of that competitive edge, and the right pieces of music, especially if associated with a campaign, it would seem to me, can indeed inspire a listener to think about someone in a different way. And if that is a positive way, if the spin is going to be, you know, this person does have more appeal to me, we have the same kind of taste in music, we believe in the same things as expressed in these lyrics, I think the impact can be really substantial. And music itself, you know, as a musician, music itself has the power to persuade as very few other things do.
Bernie from Cambridge, Connecticut, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi.
You have a suggestion.
Yes, I just had a suggestion for a Donald Trump theme song, the ballad "Am I Blue?"
Are you questioning his party loyalty there?
Well, you know, kind of wondering where he falls.
Well, Bernie, thank you so very much for your call. And we are almost out of time.
I would have suggested stormy weather.
And here is your chance, because I would like to ask our guests as their final last words, what song do you think any given candidate should use, if you have any ideas? Eric Casper, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and the author, co-author of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music, what would you pick? Do you have any ideas?
Well, you know, especially in this year when we don't have an incumbent running, you know, the Al Green Let's Stay Together, that worked pretty well for President Obama in 2012. But I think that one that kind of has some universal appeal is Tom Petty's "I Won't Back Down."
Won't back down.
And that's one that the Bush campaign tried to use, but they didn't have copyright permission and they got in trouble for it.
Robert Greenberg, any suggestions from you?
Oh my goodness! Two right off the top of my head. I would recommend that Jeb Bush continue the current tenor of his campaign by using "Rockabye Baby."
Oh,
I like. I like. Hillary Clinton should use either "I Am Woman" or "Respect."
Robert Greenberg, composer, pianist, and music historian, thank you for joining us on the show. And Sarah Schachter, anything very, very quick?
Maybe stick with younger artists. I don't know. Try and get that youth vote out. Maybe a Taylor Swift or a Katy Perry for Hillary Clinton couldn't hurt. I don't know.
Well, thank you for joining us. There is a blog post up on our site at drshow.org with all kinds of stuff, including a playlist. I'm Tamara Keith of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.